All right, well, good morning, everybody. As always, you're listening to the ASSP Healthcare Practice Specialties Health Beat Podcast. We appreciate you joining us today. Today, we've got a great episode. We're continuing with our series on best practices in the holistic area of safety and how those can be applied to the healthcare industry. And so today, we're talking to Rachel Michael, who's with the Ergonomic Practice Specialty. She's the administrator over there, and they've done a lot of great work, not only with ASSP, but of course with ergonomics in general. As a matter of fact, she did a fantastic webinar with us several months ago on ergonomics, particularly in the healthcare environment. So we're excited to have her here today. Rachel, short of me speaking for you, if you want to give our listeners just a little bit about yourself, or your career experiences, education, anything that you'd like to add, we appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks, Corey. And I have to agree with your sentiment. We did a great webinar. It's been a pleasure to work with the healthcare practice. It is something of a passion for me to integrate ergonomics and healthcare. I certainly see them as very closely aligned. So I appreciate all the cooperation we have. And I think a lot of your listeners will resonate with the idea that ergonomics does belong in healthcare and can make a definite difference there. So a little bit about me. My name is Rachel Michael. I'm a certified professional ergonomist that's certified by the Board of Certification in Professional Ergonomics and a CHSP, which is a certified healthcare safety professional. I have a master's degree in ergonomics, which is a little bit unique. Most of the master's degrees in ergonomics in the U.S., especially in the previous millennia when I my work, were sort of specialty. So it came from a lot of different places. You might have had a program was in the School of Public Health with an emphasis in ergonomics. You might have also had a program that was in the School of Mechanical Engineering that had an emphasis in ergonomics, but we weren't seeing real programs that were core specific to ergonomics. And so I actually went to Sweden to do my graduate work where I could have that experience and get that degree specifically in ergonomics and all the work designs and systems that we have there. I have been in the field ever since, a little over 20 years, a lot of it in consulting, and enjoy reaching out to anyone who has a question about how to get into ergonomics or feels that they'd like to learn a little bit more. Feel free to reach out to myself or Corey or any of these practice specialties within ASSP. We'd love to connect with you.
That's fantastic. Yeah, definitely just a great career, very prolific. And I certainly agree, you know, ergonomics in healthcare are certainly very, very integrated, you know, whether it's everything from basic workstation setups to, you know, pharmacy and lab and repetitive motion and preventing musculoskeletal disorders and strains and safe patient handling. It's definitely all there. So with that in mind, I know you mentioned this a minute ago. What are some of those different ways that it's important for us to look for ergonomics, whether in healthcare or in any environment? What are some of those different tasks or different positions or different functions, different things that are kind of at risk for ergonomic injuries?
Great question. And you hit it a little bit when you said the thought of musculoskeletal disorder. So my thesis work was actually in prevention of employee injury as well as error in hospital pharmacies. And while we focus a lot on very tactical tasks, repetitive filling of a pill jar, repetitive use of tools in the lab, repetitive lifting of patients, there actually is a lot to be said about the broader scope of ergonomics, the more strategic scope for designing systems that work with humans. When that system is going to work with the human, we're going to have an outcome of reduced risk of injury as well as reduced risk of error in the system as a whole. So where do we see that? Just like you mentioned, sure, patient handling, labs, central processing, in rehab situations where individuals are lifting or supporting the weight of other individuals, ORs where we're standing for prolonged time, bent over, looking at things. Ergonomics, particularly the physical side, comes into all aspects of healthcare. But one of the things we challenge organizations to do is really get back to the core of ergonomics. And I think a lot of us here, particularly in the U.S., have really inextricably linked ergonomics with musculoskeletal disorder prevention, which it's great at doing that. But if we look at the core of what ergonomics is, it is a design-based science, and it is a systems design-based science. So while we can use ergonomics to apply solutions to these tactical issues of a single patient handling team, a single laboratory with repetitive tasks, a single clinic, we can also use that same education to look at systems as a whole, including things like scheduling, patient safety, staff satisfaction, the ability to respond to alarms. All these kinds of things do have ergonomics components. And if we build out ergonomics from that systems perspective, we're going to have greater outcomes across everything. And that's what excites me. I love what I do. I enjoy it every day. And I enjoy very much those tactical solutions because they can be very short-term and they feel good and you get results right away. But those strategic solutions where you're working with an organization to really say, how do we make jobs match what we know about human abilities and human limitations work? That is what I really enjoy.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I definitely agree with that. You know, in terms of it, everything being a system, is that, you know, there's inputs and outputs. And so the more the system works for everybody involved, then of course it's always going to be beneficial to the outcomes. You know, if people are able to navigate that system without discomfort or injuries, then that's going to enable those processes to work better and better outcomes and less negative outcomes. So each part of that, you know, like you said, each particular part of that system has its own specifications, whether it's preventing mitigating repetitive motions or mitigating heavy lifting or awkward positions. So that's great. And it's also really good how you talk about that in the context of, you know, pragmatic functional work as opposed to, you know, I know a lot of times when I, like, for example, when I took ergonomics in my master's degree program, a lot of times that scares people half to death, you know, because it gets into some really complicated math and science and people go, I'm just trying to figure out how I don't hurt my back. You know, it's so,
very true.
Yeah. It's good that you're able to take that, you know, to where it's being used. So it gets it out of that, you know, abstract realm. But that's fantastic.
It does take it out of the abstract. And in fact, as I think back about what first excited me about this field, I remember looking at accident case studies and learning some of those root causes, particularly in aviation, which is where a lot of the cognitive ergonomics case studies came from. And while I'm oversimplifying the examples, the idea is we built enormous million-dollar machines, and then we did something very silly, like, and again, this is an exaggerated example, we put the pilot eject switch next to the gun fire switch in a fighter jet, and then expected humans in the midst of a lot of stress and a lot of pressure to choose the right switch. And in that case, they would have a 50-50 chance. And that's not about bad humans or bad pilots. That's, we designed a bad system. We could make that better. And the more I learned about examples where we knew what humans were capable of, where we knew what humans were good at, and where we knew that humans had failing, the more angry and excited I got to say, well, I need to be a part of this. If we have all this information, why aren't we designing better things? And that really sparked the interest in that 20 plus year ago decision to make this a career path, to just think, well, we have the information, why aren't we doing better with it? An example most people can relate to is your speedometer. we know that humans are bad at judging speed. So if you're driving in your car and you get pulled over and the officer says, well, do you know how fast you were going? You say, oh, I had no idea, officer. So we said, well, if we want humans to understand how fast they're going, we need to give them a system that tells them. We need that speedometer, that tachometer to say, here's how fast you're going, because humans are bad at it. But we still have systems in place where we are asking humans to judge the speed of things coming towards them, judge the speed of things they're in, and then make decisions based on that. We know that's a recipe for failure. And the challenge is to take those situations and put in place controls to meet the human where they become good performers.
Yeah, definitely. I like how you put that as well, you know, with being able to judge, you know, incoming speed or speed being traveled or how much force it takes to open a door, for example. You know, that's something that, you know, I'm sure every organization sees injuries from, is something simple like that is, you know, I hurt myself. Well, what were you doing? I was opening a door. Well, what happened? Well, I went to open the door and I realized as I was pushing it, that door weighs, you know, whatever, 50 pounds. Especially if it's, you know, got a vacuum seal or whatnot. So there's a lot of factors there. It's great that you look at all of that.
So, doors. How many reports of injury do we have from doors in healthcare? The door is too heavy. The door closed on me. The door was supposed to open. The door was left open and shouldn't be open. Yeah, I'd have to push through it. All of those things are so many issues just around doors. We see a lot of that in healthcare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's been some cases that have, you know, just been tragic where they'll have a door that, you know, controls the entrance to a radiation therapy area, and it's got an interlock on it, you know, and if that interlock fails or is corrupted or whatnot, you know, that door weighs 300 pounds, you know, it could be a horrible situation.
It could be, and I think unfortunately we in the safety profession or not in the profession but in the public purview of safety would take that and do an injury investigation, and at the end the outcome might be something very simplified and completely incorrect, like employees should have been more aware. It was the employee's fault that they moved a 300-pound door after it stopped functioning and they were injured in the process of that. Reprovide employee training. But there's no employee training that is going to tell you how to deal with that system failure in a way that protects your musculoskeletal system. And that's an organizational failure and not an individual failure. But I think we are so, can be, not all organizations, and certainly not all organizations in healthcare, but it can be possible that we still look at too low in the system for that solutions fix when it really does need to be more systemic.
Absolutely. Yeah, I do agree also that, you know, that's always an ongoing challenge is, you know, ideally we'll have, you know, redundant controls. So if one thing fails, then there's a secondary control, so it prevents those situations, and that's all part of the system, you know, so it doesn't fall back on, well, the initial control failed and the person was injured. Why? Well, because they didn't, you know, they didn't react fast enough. Mm-hmm. Where ideally what'll happen is they'll have the situational awareness, so they know what those different controls are, so they'll be able to recognize the hazard and then implement those controls.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely.
Here's a quick tip for listeners too. Something that we do is in auditing the incident analyses when we get those, one of the easy audit marks we use is aligning a control that says employee training to a specific course. So in this example, we have someone say something about that door to the radiological therapy failed. And we had an employee push it and sustain an injury from that. if in the follow-up that report says provide employee training, we redesign forms to have kind of a list next to that. It can be done electronically or on paper. But if there is not a specific course number from your organization, if there is not a class, if there is not a training name next to, employee must go through more training. If it doesn't say employee must go through more training, how to lift radiological therapy doors when it fails 101 from our organization, we kick that back. We don't accept it as a complete investigation. Because what happens is most times we find that there is not any training available and accessible within the organization that addresses the very specific nature of what the injury was. It's just a standard, oh, someone got a musculoskeletal disorder, let's talk to them about safe patient handling, when the issue was that we had a systems failure in the door. So great opportunity for your listeners to look at their own organization, take the last 10 incident reports and see if employee training was one of the corrections. Is there a very specific course named next to that? And if not, then those haven't been completed, in our opinion.
It definitely, that's important. And that's great advice. You know, unfortunately, there's a lot of situations where it'll go on the incident analysis. It'll say, you know, retraining. And then you ask that question and the intended retraining is, well, I told them to be careful, you know, and that's, it doesn't mean anything.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
You know, at a minimum, how to be careful, you know, what's the expected control? Well, you have the interlock, and the interlock has to be accessible and it has to function properly. If it doesn't, then here's what you do next. And that way, everybody knows exactly what to do. I think the biggest example I've seen of that in my career is, and this is not necessarily ergonomics, but just for an example, when employees, there was a situation I was in the past where they had told me that we're going to provide training to the team on disease exposure prevention. And I said, okay, well, fantastic. Let's do it. And I had just got there, so I wasn't part of the training development. And when I went to this training, it was an hour session, and they spent 50 minutes, like 50 minutes, talking about why tuberculosis and hepatitis and HIV, why these things were bad for you. And then they said, okay, everybody's got it. Okay, good. And I said, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to be a problem. I said, but we just talked about, you know, why nobody would want to get hepatitis or tuberculosis or HIV, but we didn't tell them how not to get it. You know, it's mm-hmm. just that, you know, we need to be talking about things like whether it's engineering controls like isolation rooms and, you know, negative positive pressure, or we're talking about source control, or whether we're talking about PPE, you know, respiratory protection programs. So yeah, to your point, you know, we've definitely got to be able to provide the appropriate training, and it's got to be pragmatic, you know, functional mm-hmm. training.
Absolutely. See, I still believe there's ergonomics in that example, because without the direction, you've left each individual to design their own control plan, and the human bias in their own design is something that we look at really, really big in ergonomics. And if you imagine when we started getting a bunch of shaped pointing devices, input devices, shaped mice and things like that, you know, they would say ergonomically designed, and particularly if they had those grooved handholds for fingers, what was immediately apparent was anyone with a smaller hand or a larger hand than the person who designed it didn't fit, because the person who designed it used only their input, their experience, and their bias in the design, and then said, oh, it's ergonomic because it fits your hand, but it doesn't fit most hands. Great example, though, about how if we don't provide that information to our employees, how are we directing what their own control plan would be? And we all have that bias. That's one of the most common human biases is we think everyone thinks like us. You drive down the road and you say, how could that idiot do that? Because I expect everybody drives like me or knows what I know or would react the way I would react. And if we don't control that within the system, we will have errors and injuries and unnecessary confusion and lapses in production because each individual is going to develop their own control plan in their head.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Definitely. And that's, I wrote an article about this where with the, you know, the ongoing pandemic, that there's a lot that can be kind of correlated with that in the subjectivity is that, you know, you look around if you just look at the media, you know, you'll see everything from the pandemic is of, you know, high risk, critical importance, we need to be doing exposure prevention and vaccinations. And then you go all the way to the other side and you've got, you know, a lot of very loud voices saying this pandemic doesn't mean a thing, don't worry about it, no source control, no vaccinations, nothing. You know, and then of course you've got all the spectrum in the middle. And so, like you said, you know, if there's not defined expectations, like in the case of the pandemic, you know, that would be things like, depending on the organization's stance and the organization's risk assessment, you know, their job safety analysis, that would be everything from preventing congregations and indoor air circulation and filtration and vaccinations and source control and hand hygiene, disinfection. And then of course you got your like healthcare providers that have respirators and PPE and contamination control zones. And so there's a lot of different factors in there, but if those aren't defined with, you know, logical expectations, then to your point, people are going to decide for themselves. And then depending on their subjective point of view, you may have people that are very highly protected and you may have people that walk right up to a patient coughing on them with nothing, you know, no respirator, no contamination control zones. And then it just becomes a coin toss as to what's going to happen next with the exposures. So yeah, it will make sense. The same thing can happen with ergonomics. You know, you either have, you know, a good amount of controls in place and a lot of prevention and system improvements, or you just leave it up to chance.
And if you think of that example in terms of productivity, how much wasted work and time and effort are EHS teams in healthcare organizations that are across jurisdictions in multiple states where there are starkly contrasting guidance to have to spend that much time and effort to try to come up with internal risk mitigation controls that do align with those external influences. And to measure this, it's going to be years wasted of EHS time and resources just to try to manage that, which is also something we see as ergonomics, this idea that we're doing so much extra work that if we could change some of those system pieces, we could reprioritize that effort into point of patient care activities, things like that.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But yeah, I know we've been kind of covering a lot of this, but I'll just ask the question just for diligence in case you want to add anything else. But as far as best practices, you know, I know we talked about incident analyses and training effectiveness and efficiency, and then you know, we talked about risk assessments and avoiding subjectivity and good objectivity. What are some of the other best practices that you have in mind?
Great question. And in fact, if any of your listeners attended the ASSP PDC virtually, you have 60 days to look at all the material. We gave a presentation, the ergonomics practice there, that talked about the difference between ergonomics as a specification-based program versus ergonomics as a performance-based program. And one of the best practices for improving the reach of your ergonomics is to really try to look at how it can be a performance-based program. A lot of organizations say they have an ergonomics program, but what they really have is an injury response program, particularly in musculoskeletal disorder injuries. So if someone gets injured, then we go out and tactically look at the very specific task that resulted in that injury, possibly blame the employee, possibly not, possibly say, you know, more training, be careful, you should have been aware, possibly not. But we really don't take all that information and feed it back into a preventative risk mitigating program that is performance-based and feeds back into the design. So if we go back to that example about the door, let's imagine we had that injury and the employee says, well, yeah, of course, we've reported it. We've reported it for months, but maintenance is busy. It's got a hot sauce ticket. Hasn't been done. So we go down and we interview maintenance. We said, oh, yeah, they went up and they oiled it once. They checked the pneumatics on it. Okay. And then it keeps getting in the system. We don't have time. We don't have space. So we have all these factors coming in that we know now we've got some disconnect between how maintenance sees things, or maybe once maintenance fixes it, if it breaks again, does that get escalated? Are employees able to see the status of a fix in the system so that they know, hey, this has not been fixed, and they don't have to find out when they push it? Those types of things, if those aren't prescribed in your program, how to look for that, and there's not a real way how for your organization, you have to determine how you do that. That's why it's performance-based. But if you don't have a way to look at those bigger system issues, you don't truly yet have an ergonomics program. And if you want to see more about performance versus specification-based ergonomics programs, log in to the PDC, and you've got a few months to capture all that information. But a best practice is really remembering that ergonomics is about proactive design, and when it needs to be, reactive redesign, which is a little bit bigger than that idea of just injury mitigation, musculoskeletal disorder prevention for our hospital and healthcare staff.
That's great input. Definitely very important. We definitely recommend everybody check out the presentations from the Safety 2021. there's a lot of factors that can be looked at proactively, and those are all important parts of that system that can lead to prevention and ultimately, with all that due diligence, it increases the safety culture, you know, because each time we're able to articulate those controls, you know, that puts that much more validity that employees know there's a preventative, proactive culture there. So the interesting part about ergonomics, of course, is that, you know, this has been an ongoing discussion, as you know, for many years, but there's not a, you know, there's not a hard line regulation. You know, there's guidance, but there's not a regulation around it. What are your thoughts about the OSHA stance on ergonomics? Do you think it's effective? What would you like to see with that?
It's a great question. It has long been something of debate, and long been something that a lot of working groups have worked on. So we did have a federal ergonomics program standard for a few weeks at one point in time, but we do not now. California has a standard, they call it a repetitive motion ergonomics program standard, and the federal standard was based on that. Washington State also for a number of years did have a similar performance-based program standard until that was legislatively repealed. It has been attempted in a number of other jurisdictions. It's been attempted in Michigan. It's been attempted in North Carolina. There are some small jurisdiction level standards, including in New York City, that were related to ergonomics, and those dealt largely with backpack weight and school children and the idea of districts providing resources. This was before everything was on the tablet, so that students didn't have 60-pound backpacks carrying the history book and the math book and everything around. But you are correct. We do not have any federal standard for ergonomics. We often cite the general duty clause, OSHA's general duty clause, which requires employers to maintain a workplace free of hazards. And we have seen that clause applied in citations in healthcare, particularly in long-term care. In Ohio has some examples of that. Other jurisdictions have successfully used the general duty clause to cite organizations for failing to respond to known hazards. How you get a known hazard is largely through your experience mod, your DART rates, and things like that. Excuse me. Is it effective? No, and it's also a very low regulatory risk. And I think a lot of organizations who use risk of citation as one of their primary drivers correctly see that this is a very low regulatory risk for them, which is why those specification-based ergonomics programs are not going to perform well. If an organization, however, says, regardless of the regulatory risk, we are going to have a performance-based ergonomics program that looks at how to continuously improve job design and match it to our human capabilities and limitations, then you've taken care of any potential regulatory risk because you're doing the right thing and you're doing it well. But I think we will, as a federal OSHA and the state OSHA programs continue to struggle to see a performance-based standard for ergonomics implemented. There are some other examples of federal OSHA performance-based standards. So there are some precedent for it, but this one in particular has been very difficult to match with how the agency, OSHA, looks at things and finds solutions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's definitely a lot of factors there, and it's always interesting how it's been addressed at the regulatory level. So yeah, it's I like how you put that with, you know, the organizations there, you know, their risk management strategy is, well, we look at the probability of an inspection or a fine, you know, and then we account for those regulations accordingly. But you know, the tough part of that is that even if every regulation is completely in compliance, you know, it means you have minimal safe conditions, but you know, it doesn't really account for safe work practices or anything above that. So with ergonomics not being a hard regulation, it creates a little bit of a different situation there. Interesting stuff.
It does, and healthcare is so regulated. I completely understand and sympathize with the idea that we don't need one more regulation in healthcare, and I believe that, because I think with all of the regulation you already have between accreditations and all the numerous extra things that are required of healthcare that's different from general industry, you've got great potential to treat ergonomics as a performance-based program in your organization and not worry about it from a regulatory standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, it's always interesting how, you know, different perspectives influence the way that people, or not perspectives, I'm sorry, but different factors, you know, such as regulation and consensus standards and, you know, how those things affect the way that safety is led in an organization or even in a city or state or a country for that matter, you know, with everything going on lately. So speaking of that, you know, speaking of the different influences and the way that everything affects each other component, you know, aside from the workplace safety, you know, the ergonomics and the, you know, the workplace conditions and the environment and everything, are there any other issues that you or the ergonomics practice specialty look at, anything involving things like wellness or fatigue management or anything of that nature?
Fatigue management is actually coming out as a really interesting new piece that we can do better now. So in the past, we've had metabolic analysis tools. We've measured individual muscle fiber fatigue, and we've measured kind of the idea of, you know, how is heat stress, what is the metabolic output, is the human fatigued. And what we're seeing, actually, what recently came out in the last couple of years are a couple of task analysis tools that really do a better job at integrating a fatigue factor into that overall score. So there's a couple of those out. They're being presented at conferences now. They are still within an academic domain, so they are free to for individuals to look at and use. And so fatigue management is something that we're seeing really be able to be built into ergonomics analyses better than it has been in the last 20 years. So that's exciting to have that coming down. Some other things that we're working on in the ergonomics PS is we've got a webinar coming up later this year about an anthropometry selection tool that has been made available to the public. The tool has always been available, but it was cumbersome and it was really paper-based. And so the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society has taken that tool and digitized it, put it into a format so any individual, and it's free to the public, can input specific anthropometric or workplace dimensions and be able to say, well, based on what we're planning with this new design, we only match 30% of the population. That's not good enough. And this is where we get into the performance-based specifications, having specification features. If we say we want our job design to match 75% of the population, that's a specification, but the performance around it is how we get there. So we're going to use this tool to be able to say, hey, how does this fit? What is my design good? Can people fit in it? And to have that publicly available in an easier form, I think is really accessible. So we're trying to bring that information out to more of our general EHS practitioners in healthcare, in general industry, anywhere, this great tool that has been available, but just very cumbersome, particularly if you were not kind of deeply involved in ergonomics, is now accessible to all of our EHS practitioners. So that's exciting. We're trying to bring that information, and we're always looking for engagement. Certainly in the last year, we've had more Zoom calls than our practice has ever had. We've had coffee breaks. We've spoken to students. We've had connect with a professional. And we're just excited to keep sharing our love of this piece of our profession with old and new practitioners in the field.
That's fantastic. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of aspects to discuss, you know, and to learn from. So there's, you know, not only the fundamental, you know, core stuff about work and safety and environmental and whatnot, but then you've got all those things that influence that in everybody's personal life, you know, which also impacts the work environment. So yeah, like you said, you know, fatigue and overexhaustion and burnout and all these different things that play into that. So that's great that y'all are doing all those things.
And we are, and we've also been, not we RPS, but individuals within our group have been closely aligned with the NIOSH Total Worker Health Initiative. The director for that program has been a speaker at industry conferences. So the idea that there is a total worker health at home, at work, safety really comes into it with ergonomics. And in fact, we often try to use an example in ergonomics, particularly about musculoskeletal control, that if you see something that you're about to do, lift this heavy thing, move it on your own, climb up a ladder and try to pull something off a shelf, and we say, you know, would you let your spouse do that alone? Would you let your 16-year-old do that task you're about to do? No, you'd say, stop, let me get help, this looks dangerous. And so we try to say that this is applicable throughout, and it's applicable at home, and it's applicable at work, and it's really about having a safe, a holistically safe experience for everyone you care about in all aspects. People will injure their back at home too, and we want to be able to prevent that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I like how you put that, you know, with, you think about it from that perspective of what, you know, would you want that to happen at, you know, at your house or in your community or, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of times there tends to be a different perspective, you know, mm-hmm. at work. I'll look at it and go, well, you know, it's being regulated and there's policies around this and, you know, well, I don't want to get written up or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Or the opposite. They'll say, well, you know, I know it's unsafe, but we got production goals, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
Whereas at home, you know, a lot of times people go, it's Saturday, I'm not going to hurt myself and have to go to the hospital. You know, it's like.
Exactly. You know, yes.
Yeah. Or the opposite, where they'll say, well, you know, it's, you know, Saturday, nobody's watching, I do whatever I want. You know, if I want to.
Mm-hmm.
I want to climb up on the roof to put the Christmas lights up and hang off the gutter, you know, with mm-hmm. you know, protecting me. That's my business, you know, but mm-hmm. to your point, you know, if you fall off that gutter and then you can't go to work on Monday, then that creates a different situation.
Absolutely. When we do training around this, there's a question we ask around the room. We say, you know, what would you do? And this is applicable to any health and safety objective. We say, if you won the lottery tomorrow, what would you do? And a lot of people choose very physical things. They say, I want to travel the world. I'm going to move to the state where my grandkids are and go to every one of their softball games. We have people that say, I want to finally rebuild that old car I have. It's something very physical, requires strength, awkward postures. We don't generally see anybody say, you know, I hope that my retirement is laying on the couch, barely able to move or unable to fly because my back injury doesn't allow me to sit for more than 4 hours. You know, when we think of what we want outside of work, it really is to have this active, comfortable, pain-free lifestyle. And that's more difficult if we spend 20 years doing tasks that do break up our body. And if there's any opportunity for us to think of that while we're in the point of process at work to say, yeah, but I really wanted to take this anniversary trip to Europe. And that involves a long plane flight. So I'm going to be careful with my back here at work because I want to be able to do that later. And again, applicable with any health and safety issue, really. But it's interesting to try to get that perspective from people when they think of how their future perception of themselves intersects with the work they're doing right now.
And that's a great perspective. You know, it's very true. You know, it's like things may seem, you know, of one level of urgency and importance, you know, in the moment, but you know, when you look at that in a different context, you know, you say, well, you know, if I take the time and focus my efforts on doing this thing safely right now, then it reduces the chance that there's going to be something that happens that's going to affect, you know, everything after this. And that's very important. You know, sometimes we can't eliminate the risk, but we can mitigate it. And then sometimes, you know, a lot of times people get that perception where they'll say, well, you know, there's such a low chance that something bad is going to happen. But
mm-hmm.
and I always, you know, to kind of in line with what you're saying, I always remind them, I say, well, you know, let's say that today's today you hit that unlucky number and the bad thing does happen. I say, you know, do you want to have to remember this and go, well, you know, if I had just taken the time to follow the safety protocol, you know, then I said, but, or do you think to yourself, well, you know, well, I thought there was a low chance of it happening. And, you know, it's not going to seem that way in hindsight, you know? So it's, just getting,
no, I'm putting on those. Sitting on those ball field stands isn't comfortable for even a young person with a good back. It's miserable if you have a back injury. If you want to sit and watch your kids and grandkids play ball, you need to be thinking about being safe at work.
Yeah, that totally. You know, it's interesting how you say that too. Is you know, I always think about that as, like, I have, you know, autoimmune disorders that I don't know where they came from. It's one of those things I literally woke up with. But if I had the magic crystal ball and I could tell, you know, what had caused them, and if I could go back and remove those things so that I don't have to live with this, you know, condition, that's certainly something I would do, you know, because it's going to affect every day for the rest of my life, you know. I guess the upside of that is I don't know where it came from, so I don't necessarily have that same perspective of like, well, if I had just followed the protocol, you know. But if it was that, if it was in that that perspective, then yeah, I'd definitely want to be able to prevent it. So that's great advice, and that's good good discussions that y'all do. That's really impressive. But well, heck,
thank you.
Totally, thank you. But yeah, we just got just a couple more minutes. I know I don't want to take up your whole day. I know you're very busy. So I was going to ask, is there anything y'all have coming up with ASSP? Anything you want to plug today?
Ooh, that's a great question, and thank you for that space. We do have two webinars coming up at the end of this year. We don't have the full dates and information on that. We do have them approved for CEUs, so if you're looking to get a couple more CEUs to round out what you need to have for the year, look for our webinars coming up on that, and I'm sure I'll send a copy to Corey so he can post in the healthcare practice specialty as well. So we do have a couple webinars coming up for the end of the year, but we don't have the specific dates yet. What about you guys? What's healthcare doing?
Yeah, totally. We have a webinar coming up in October, and we're going to be going over the OSHA ETS for COVID-19. And then November 5th, we're going to be doing a webinar on fatigue prevention and preventing burnout. So we're excited about that. And then
fantastic. Great information. I'll sign up for those.
Cool. Thank you. Yeah, that'd be great. And yeah, and then we're doing a lot of podcasting. So, you know, what this episode we're doing right now, this is actually part of a 6-part series that we're doing where we're talking to several different practice specialties and different, you know, industry safety pros. And we're talking about best practices and everything that's going on there. So, yeah, we're talking today about ergonomics, and we're also be talking to the environmental practice specialty. We're talking to public sector practice specialty, the emerging professionals. We're going to talk about diversity. And then we're talking to industrial hygiene. And then we're also talking to WISE, the Blacks in Safety Excellence. And then we talked to WISE about a month ago. We talked to Abby, Women in Safety Excellence. So we're trying to really kind of drive the collaboration and, you know, getting all different perspectives so we can avoid any, you know, silos or echo chambers or anything like that, you know.
Fantastic. Good job.
Oh, no, thank you. We appreciate you being here. But well, yeah, the last thing I always ask everybody is, so if you had a, you know, the magic wand and you could wave it and change something about safety or specifically ergonomics or regulations or culture or wellness, if there's something that you could just wave the magic wand and change, what would that be?
And this is the short answer? Oh boy. Wave the magic wand. I wish in the U.S. Industries and the public would see that the burdens and costs and indirect costs of poor ergonomics is something that does affect us all monetarily, in terms of production and in terms of profitability for organizations as well. And one of the examples I give for that was many years ago, purchasing a new washer and dryer from a common retailer scheduled to be delivered to the house. I'm there to meet the delivery person, and deliveries in the U.S. tend to be a young man's game. Get guys in there, break their backs, move on. And as these gentlemen were unloading the washer and dryer from a standard truck, with no assists, of course the box dropped and fell. And we opened the box and it had, the fall had dented the appliance. And so I refused to take it. I said, I'm sorry guys, but I'm not going to accept this. It's been damaged. And they kind of said, yeah, no problem. It happens all the time. And they load it back up and off we go. And a few weeks later, I get another delivery. And if we think of this from a perspective of there's a solution for this, it's a lift on the end of the truck. And in some areas of the world, it's standard, it's required, because it stands to reason that if you are delivering something from a truck to the ground, you would need to lift it. And to do that safely with the least amount of product damage, you should have a lift gate. But that's not how we look at things here in all places, where we say there's a very short-term cost savings of between $3,000 and $5,000 on the lift, but the consumer, we end up paying for that in the prices of our appliances that repetitively get dropped off the trucks and sent back, and that's just kind of built into our consumer cost, as well as in the potential injury to our friends and family members who have a known solution to protect their back when lifting a heavy object from a truck, but the employer isn't providing it for them, and there's not a regulatory response or requirement to do so. How frustrating is that for a family whose young father is unable to work now because of a summer job trying to move things like that? So there is a big cost, and if we view it as a societal cost, I think we'd see more willingness to say, hey, let's look at these solutions. Yes, I'm not going to accept an appliance if it doesn't come on a truck with a lift gate, because I don't want to have any damages or fight with you over warranty. And that's going to be something that the consumers and the public can drive, where we've always actually been expecting the companies and organizations behind it to drive. So in my magic wand, Rachel Designs Ergonomics in the U.S., that's what I'd like to see.
That's fantastic. Yeah, that's definitely very valid. You know, there's a lot of those situations where, you know, it's not a mystery as far as what's needed to prevent the injuries. It's just a matter of having it and preventing the, you know, using the brute force option. Because that's definitely true. You know, it rings true to me, because I think to myself often, there's a lot of things that, you know, I used to do when I was in the military, and, you know, now that, you know, many years have passed since I've been out of the military and I have a, you know, different set of circumstances, like a lot of that I can't do anymore, like physically. And so I can't help but think, I'm like, if I relied on the ability to do those things to, you know, for a living, I would have to find a different line of work. So I really sympathize and empathize with anybody who's lost their ability to, you know, perform certain functions that they used to do regularly.
Absolutely. And I think there's been some great discussion in ASSP and in both our organizations about bringing sympathy and empathy into safety more, instead of berating you for costing the company money with your injury, to really take empathy and sympathy into account and say, wow, what was your experience here? And then hopefully turn it into something that prevents it from happening again.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's one of those things that I've heard it a couple times in the, you know, the 17 years I've been doing this, is it always breaks my heart when someone will say to me, you know, well, you know, we're just gonna keep doing it that way. We know it's risky, but you know, if somebody gets hurt, we'll just pay the claim, and if we get fined, we'll pay the fine, and that's cheaper than having to implement the, you know, the process control or the or even the compliance with the regulation, you know. And I can you know, we can keep fighting those battles. And the part that's difficult about it is not only is there eventually there's going to be a point where something's going to happen and we're going to have to explain why that control is not there. And then the other thing is eventually we're going to talk to those employees and they're going to want to know why that control's not there and why they're hurt, you know, and it's a difficult thing. I've had a lot of people ask me that question, like, well, what do you do about that? And I said, well, you know, we work on change, you know, change management and culture change as much as we can. You know, we the hazard analysis, the controls, the communication, the leading indicators, the lagging indicators, we do the whole safety management system. We push every button we can. We talk to everybody we can. We, you know, we go to the meeting, shake the hands. Well, not shake the hands now with the pandemic, but, you know, if it comes to that brick wall, you know, where it's just not going to happen. And, you know, eventually, you know, sometimes we have to make those decisions if that's the organization we want to work for. It can be difficult.
But what if our teams use this as a challenge to upper leadership, where we're seeing so many more kind of think tank comments about leadership and the skills of leadership and the empathy being a core value? And if we have a department manager, a leader, a CEO of an organization come out in an annual statement and say, hey, you know, we've got a new social governance task force and I am a leader and I'm leading with empathy, that we take this example up to that leader with empathy and say, does it feel empathetic when we say pay the claim, you know, pay the fine and discard the human experience that resulted in injury here? And maybe that's a way for us to start that conversation. And I don't know that I've seen that conversation really taking place in the scope of the new social governance and kind of a changing leadership style we're seeing.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, to your point, that also ties directly into, you know, being a employer of preference and also what's the word I'm looking for? Corporate citizenship, you know, and all that, of course, ties into the, you know, the big overarching ethics that everybody should strive for. So, yeah, that's a great perspective. And that may be a good thing we can do a webinar on.
Yes, our next collaboration. I like it, Corey.
Cool. Yeah, that sounds good. We can talk offline and get that going. I'm into it.
Yeah. Sounds good. Me as well.
Cool. Yeah. Well, heck, I know you're busy and I don't want to take up your whole day, so we can go ahead and tie it up. But if you're up for it, you know, it's always a open invitation. You're welcome to come back and we can certainly find plenty more to talk about.
Thanks, Corey. I've enjoyed this very much.
Cool. Thank you. We appreciate you being here. So with that being said, we'll go ahead and wrap that up. But for everybody listening, we were talking about just a couple minutes ago, definitely check out the upcoming events. Like Rachel was saying, the Ergonomics Practice Specialties got a lot of webinars and they've got their coffee talk and all their good stuff coming up there. And then us over here at the healthcare practice specialty, we got webinars in October and November, and then we'll have more coming up in the winter. And then check out our podcast. We're at anchor.fm/ASSP-HCPS-HealthBeat. And with today's episode with Rachel, we're going to have 22 episodes up, so definitely check that out. We got episodes ranging from today's ergonomics. We have a panel about ergonomics with the team over at Akron Children's Hospital. We've got a panel about needle stick sharps injury prevention. We have a panel about workplace violence. We got episodes with Norman Ritchie, Sean Galloway. We got Dr. Amber Mitchell. All different kinds of people on there. So feel free to check that out. And as always, if anybody has a topic or anything that you're looking for in particular, feel free to let us know. You can always reach us on the ASSP communities on LinkedIn or on Twitter. Our new Twitter feed is at ASSP HCPS. So with that being said, we'll check in with everybody real soon. Have a great day.